We have a little difference in the time up here in our watches, but I think it's time we got going on this. My name is Walt West. I'm supposed to be introducing these speakers and keeping time on things and making sure that nobody's here that doesn't belong. Subject is the Book of Mormon. Could Joseph Smith have written it? Theoretically. Taken from an outsider's point of view, but both the speaker and the responder have had a lot of time studying and on this subject. Robert Reese has been an editor of Dialogue, has made other presentations in past years at the Sunstone Symposium, and you'll see his name frequently. Mark Thomas has written this little book, and he's been studying the Book of Mormon. He's been studying the Book of Mormon for many years. So it's going to be an interesting session, and I'm not going to waste any more of your time with my words. We'll turn right over to Robert Reese at this time.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I was interested in that. To find out there are people here who shouldn't be here. Before, as the last session ended, someone came up and told me that he had heard from somebody at BYU that I had been excommunicated, so maybe I shouldn't be here. But I assure you I haven't been and don't intend to be excommunicated, but I do intend to be here. The subject of my paper is Above the American Renaissance, Could Joseph Smith Have Written the Book of Mormon? Over the course of a lifetime, I have read the Book of Mormon a number of times. I have taught it in seminary, institute, and gospel doctrine classes, written about it, and read extensively in the secondary literature relating to it, both that literature which supports Joseph Smith's claims about its origins and that which postulates that it is a product of a 19th century imagination. I am a literary critic, one who has spent a professional lifetime reading, teaching, and writing about literary texts. Much of my interest in and approach to the Book of Mormon lies in its text. But it isn't just as a landscape for scholarly exploration that draws me to the book. It is, as well, a recognition that the words, images, and stories there come alive as I give myself to them thoughtfully, imaginatively, and spiritually. These scriptures, to use Jeremiah's phrase, make me feel as if there is a fire shut up in my bones. Even before it was published, the Book of Mormon generated controversy about its origin. And immediately after it was published, theories about its composition began to abound. Some said that Smith must be the author, and others countered that he was too ignorant and rusticated to have written such a book. Over the course of the years, numerous theories about the authorship and composition of the Book of Mormon have been put forth. These range from it being a tale told by an idiot, devoid of either sound or fury, and signifying nothing very important, to the latest claims that it is a book penned by a genius who was inspired by God. In each instance, Joseph Smith is, of course, respectively, both the idiot and the genius, both devil-inspired and God-inspired, and it is reasonable to conclude that whatever he was not both. Lewis Midgley has summarized these various attempts to explain the book into four categories. 1, Joseph Smith wrote the book as a conscious fraud. 2, Joseph Smith wrote the book under the influence of some sort of paranoia or demonic possession or dissociative illusion. 3, Joseph Smith had the help of someone like Sidney Rigdon in creating the book as a conscious fraud. And 4, Joseph Smith wrote the book while under some sort of religious inspiration. What is intriguing about these theories is their range, from country bumpkin to sophisticated genius, from simple self-delusion to complicated conspiracy, and from demonic to divine inspiration. Each assessment of the book included seeing it as, early assessments of the book included seeing it as, quote, the result of gross imposition and a grosser superstition, the ramblings of a digger for treasure, as a book inspired by Satan, as a compilation, quote, of every error and almost every truth discussed in New York during the 10 years before its publication. Others saw it as a clear work of plagiarism, suggesting that Smith took the basic plot and much of the substantive content of the book from Ethan Hale's History of the Hebrews, or a fictional narrative written by Solomon Spaulding. Governor Ford of Illinois saw it as, quote, the fumes of an enthusiastic and fantastical imagination. Louis Dougal saw it as the work of a genuinely deluded but undisciplined brain. And I, Woodbridge Riley, saw it as the product of, quote, subjective hallucination induced by hypnotic suggestion. Bernard DeVoto, who postulated that Smith wrote the book under the spell of epileptic seizures, assessed the book as, quote, a yeasty fermentation, formless, aimless, and inconceivably absurd, the estrus of a paranoid projected it into a new Bible. And Mark Twain gave it the cleverest and briefest of sobriquets when he said the entire book should have been called Ether because it was chloroform in print. In the 18th century, there was a controversy over the authenticity of a collection of prose poems called Ossian, which James McPherson had written, but which he tried to pass off as the work of a 3rd century blind poet named Ossian. The book was extremely popular in both Europe and America, and most people considered it authentic. The venerable Samuel Johnson, upon being asked whether he thought the work could have been written by a modern man, replied, "Yes, sir. Many men, many women, and many children." Sometimes I get the impression that some of the critics have the same opinion of the Book of Mormon, that not only could many men, women, and possibly even children have written it, but that any fool could have, and one particular fool, Joseph Smith, certainly did. While 19th century estimates tended to see the book as the product of a deluded or demonic mind, 20th century evaluations tended to be more modern, if no more reasonable. After the advent of Freud, it was inevitable that someone would try to explain the Book of Mormon in strictly psychological terms. The first significant attempt was Spawn Brody's No Man Knows My History in 1954, which argued that the book was nothing more than a playing out of Joseph Smith's fantasies and the Smith family's psychological history. At the turn of this new century, this has been one of the more persistent explanations. Robert Anderson's Inside the Mind of Joseph Smith, published last year, is the latest and most comprehensive attempt to provide a psychological explanation of Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon. As a literary critic, I'm aware of the multiple ways of looking at a book or at a blackbird. Sometimes when I teach a text, the students and I examine it from the perspectives of various critical approaches: new critical, historical, biographical, Freudian, Marxist, feminist, deconstructionist, reader response, etc. All of these might be considered legitimate approaches to the text as long as they don't become too extreme or doctrinaire, which they often do. When one reads very much contemporary criticism, one is reminded of Emerson's statement, "Tell me your sect, and I'll tell you your argument." Over the years, as I have read the opinions, analyses, examinations, and theories of various scholars, I've been intrigued by the chasm that tends to divide the believers from the non-believers, the apologists from the naturalists, those who consider the text divine as opposed to those who accept a more naturalistic explanation of its origins. One of the things that characterizes the relationship between these two camps, and I call it a relationship since I don't think dialogue accurately describes their discourse, is their tendency to dismiss, label, and put down one another. In this presentation, I question neither the motives, the credentials, the spirituality, nor the sincerity of those who challenge the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. Nor do I question the motives, credentials, judgment, scholarship, or testimonies of those who consider the Book of Mormon a natural history of ancient American peoples. Since I have been labeled both an apologist and a naturalist critic, generally in pejorative terms, I have watched this exchange with interest. I am grateful for anyone who has sincerely tried to come to terms with this most fascinating of books. Those who have challenged the Book of Mormon by exploring its 19th century setting have often raised important issues, some of which apologists tend to dismiss too easily. On the other hand, a number of devoted Mormon scholars have likewise raised important issues that have deepened and broadened both the book's text and its possible connection to its purported ancient setting. Naturalist critics often unfairly and at times even dishonestly dismiss the findings of this group. What is fascinating is that one group looks at the book and finds only a plethora of parallels to the late decades of the 18th and early 19th centuries, which convince them that the book is a product of a modern mind. The other group finds numerous parallels with the ancient world and concludes that the book could only have been originated with ancient peoples. Since the parallels, or at least some of them, that each group finds are legitimate, what are we to conclude? One feels that the argument is often reduced to, my parallels are better and more authentic and more persuasive than your parallels. It is interesting that in the past decade, a new group of scholars have staked out territory somewhat between the two traditional camps. These scholars, of whom Anthony A. Hutchinson and David B. Wright are representative, consider Joseph Smith a prophet and the Book of Mormon inspired, but do not consider it an authentic ancient work. They consider that the speakers of the Book of Mormon have important things to say to our generation, even though they are fictional characters. For example, Hutchinson feels, quote, the Book of Mormon should be seen as authoritative scripture. God remains the author of the Book of Mormon, viewed as the Word of God, but Joseph Smith and this construct would be the book's inspired human author rather than its inspired translator. I don't see much difference between Hutchinson's approach and that of biblical scholars who have quested for the historical Jesus. And if you are looking for the historical Jesus, it is unlikely that you will find the divine Christ. Also, if Alma is a fictional rather than a historical character, and if the Jesus who speaks in 3 Nephi is really Joseph Smith trying to imagine what Jesus would have said had he visited ancient America, it raises important questions. If one considers these questions irrelevant and believes that the central point of the text is to provide a guide for moral behavior or to inspire better living, then questions of ultimate meaning, for example, whether God moves through history and whether Jesus was the literal Son of God who atoned for the sins of all of Adam's children, must also be considered irrelevant or at least unimportant. One of the issues that this approach raises, of course, is the same issue that C.S. Lewis talks about when he said, you cannot have Christ both as the greatest moral teacher in history and also having him telling lies about his origin. A related but different approach is offered by Mark Thomas in his new book, Digging in Cumorah, Reclaiming Book of Mormon Narratives. Thomas, who hopes his work is the beginning of, quote, a foundation for new tradition in the Book of Mormon studies, states, in the end, a book's authority lies less in its origin than in its messages. Although Thomas tries diligently to keep a neutral position on the question of textual origin, it seems to me that it reveals a possible bias against the apologist position. For example, he states, quote, we will never find the book's real value or message until we set aside the apologetic issues of authorship, at least temporarily. Later, he states, biblical scholarship has faced similar interpretive problems with apologetic interests interfering with interpretation. One would hope that Thomas would be as demanding about the naturalist issues of authorship and acknowledge that rationalist interests at times also interfere with interpretation. Thus, while the text is paramount, questions about its origin are hardly irrelevant, although I am willing to concede that some such discussion may be irrelevant and some certainly misguided. Were Moroni a fictional character in a historical novel written by Joseph Smith, I think I would still find his discourse on charity and his invitation to come unto Christ inspiring. But they would have more meaning and a more profound impact when I consider that they are the words of a man who walked the earth as I do and who struggled with his soul and its relation to his Savior. I don't believe these are Joseph Smith's thoughts or that these words came out of his specific experience, even though they are expressed in his language. One of the primary reasons to read Scripture, I believe, is that in seeing how God acts in the lives of others, we feel emboldened to invite him to act in similar ways in our lives. When we see God acting in history, we believe that the ultimate fate of the world is in his hands. When we believe that he truly sent his Son to die for our sins, we are inspired to change our hearts to, in the words of King Lamoni, give away all of our sins to know him. I do not believe that fictional characters, no matter how well drawn, can so inspire us. And as a teacher of literature, I find fictional characters tremendously inspiring. But I don't believe that they can so inspire us because we can always distance ourselves from them. We suspend our disbelief, but it is still disbelief. So the question I pose today, is it reasonable to argue that Joseph Smith could have written the Book of Mormon? Was it possible, given his knowledge of cultures, languages, literature, and history, the amount of time he had to produce such a book, the imaginative capacity to create a fresh and original narrative peopled by an interesting array of characters, the level of sophistication necessary to design and execute such a complicated book with so many varied literary forms and styles, and finally, the good fortune to guess right in so many instances? In considering each of these categories or questions, I look at Joseph Smith in relation to his contemporary authors, those who make up the pantheon of American literature from early to mid-century. The Book of Mormon came out of the richest creative period in American culture, what the critic F.O. Matheson termed the American Renaissance. In his book of the same title, subtitled Art and Expression in the Age of Emerson and Whitman, Matheson chronicles what Van Wyck Brooks has termed the flowering of New England. That flowering, which produced such masterpieces as Poe's stories and poems, Emerson's essays, Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, Melville's Moby Dick, Thoreau's Walden, and Whitman's Leaves of Grass, not to mention the astonishing poetry of Emily Dickinson and a host of minor masterpieces, took place in the same fertile ground out of which the Book of Mormon was published. Was the Book of Mormon a product of what David S. Reynolds has called the subversive imagination in the age of Emerson and Melville, which is the subtitle of his book, Beneath the American Renaissance? Or was it what Joseph Smith claimed it to be, an ancient sacred text whispering out of the ground to modern readers? First, let's consider time. I begin with a quote from Thoreau's Walden, "Time is but the stream I go a-fishing in." One of the things all writers know is that writing takes time, generally lots of it, to get the writing right. Good writing takes time, and the trick is to make it seem easy and seamless. This reminds me of an experience I had in China. I was in charge of a delegation of American writers who were traveling through China having a series of conversations with Chinese writers. When the subject of the difficulty of writing came up, I told the story of the young British writer, Christopher Nolan, who had just won the Whitbread Prize. Nolan had been born without the ability to speak, and as a paralyzed spastic, as they call them in Britain, he did not have enough control over his muscles to write or type. When he was 11, a new drug, Lioresal, gave him enough control over his neck muscles so that he could awkwardly type a stick using a stick attached to his forehead. What came out was an amazing rush of poetry and prose that was published as Damn Burst of Dreams. This dreams that had been held in this young man's head and suddenly burst forth. It's a wonderful book. In his second book, Under the Eye of the Clock, for which he won the Whitbread Prize, Nolan speaks of the laborious task of writing in which it takes him sometimes 12 hours to type out a single poem. After I told this story to the group of Chinese and American writers, Charles Wright, winner of both the Pulitzer and the National Book Award prizes for poetry, remarked, 12 hours for one poem? Well, that's about right. But in practice, it often takes a great deal more time. As Donald Hall, one of our most venerated contemporary poets, says, "It is typical for me to spend 3 to 5 years on a poem, but not working on it every day, but maybe every day for 6 months, then nothing for 6 months, then starting it again. At the beginning, every draft changes a lot, but toward the end, I may spend a lot of time changing a word from the end of one line to the beginning of the next. There are several poems I've worked on over 20 years. A number of scholars had pointed out that during the time the work of translation was going on, Joseph Smith was plagued with numerous mundane concerns: finding work, feeding his family, protecting the plates, burying a stillborn child, etc. In other words, there were so many stresses and strains that daily systematic writing would have been out of the question. In an article entitled "For Authors, Fragile Ideas Need Loving Every Day," The novelist Walter Mosley speaks of the importance of a routinized, disciplined approach to writing. Arguing that writing is a quotidian endeavor, Mosley says that interruption and distractions, such as those that Joseph Smith had in abundance, cause the life to drain out of your writing. The words have no art to them. You no longer remember the smell. The idea seems weak. It has dissipated like smoke. Most writers recognize that good writing is seldom easy and rarely flows seamlessly from the writer's pen or keyboard, and certainly not from straight dictation. The more complicated, complex, and sophisticated the text, the more time it takes to compose. While some writers speak of writing mellifluously flowing lines as if under a spell, in reality, this seldom happens, and if it does, it doesn't last. When asked about the place of impulse or inspiration in his writing, Hall states, "It's 20 seconds of impulse and 2 years of attention." The creation of forms of literature, such as one finds in abundance in the Book of Mormon, a complicated narrative with many twists, turns, returns, foreshadowings, and archetypes, numerous kinds of parallelism, including extensive and complicated chiasms and complex parallel poetic forms, and many different styles, took someone a considerable time to compose. This is not the kind of book one dashes off in a few months as one might a romance novel. This kind of writing takes time, and lots of it. How much time did Joseph Smith have to write the Book of Mormon? This much seems to be part of the historical record. After losing the first 116 pages of the book through Martin Harris's negligence, Joseph did not resume his work of translation until 22nd September 1828, although he seems to have written little until Oliver Cowdery became his scribe on the 5th of April 1829. Between that date and the 11th of June that same year, the day Joseph applied for a copyright, Joseph and Oliver completed the work of translation. This is in approximately 90 days. By any measure, this is an astonishing accomplishment. As a straight work of translation or inspired dictation, this would be a formidable task. What about Joseph Smith's contemporary authors? Without exception, they worked on their masterpieces over considerable lengths of time. Each writer's magnum opus was years in the preparing and writing. In one respect, Nathaniel Hawthorne had been writing The Scarlet Letter for 25 years before it was actually published. That is, most of the themes, character types, and situations in his novel were developed to one extent or another in the notes, sketches, and stories Hawthorne wrote from 1825 to 1850. As to the actual time of the writing of the novel, Arlen Turner notes that by the end of August 1849, Hawthorne, quote, was writing immensely, so his wife phrased it. Typically, he would put in 9 hours a day at his desk. Hawthorne wrote his friend Horatio Bridge that the book had been finished on February 3, 1850, for a total of more than 5 months of time in the book's composition. Critics speak of Melville's tri-works, the works of fiction he wrote that prepared him to write Moby Dick. His previous novels of the sea, Marty, Umu, Typee, Redburn, and White Jacket, were all novels in which Melville was working out both his subject matter and his style. Moby Dick, which took Melville more than 6 months to complete, reveals indebtedness to all of these earlier works. Melville, whose education, both formal and experiential, was far superior to Joseph Smith, said, "My development," and by that he meant his development as a thinker and writer, "has all been within the past few years. Until I was 25, I had no development at all." In other words, at the same age in which Joseph Smith had written as large a book as Moby Dick, Melville, recognized as one of the literary masters of American literature, was just beginning to feel confident as a writer, and Moby Dick was still far into the future. Henry David Thoreau spent nearly 9 years writing Walden. Here again, Thoreau's early writing both prepared him for and contained many of the ideas and themes of his major opus. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote nothing as sustained as the Book of Mormon, but his essays, which represent his major contribution to the literary age that bears his name, were produced over a lifetime. In his early nature, as F.O. Matheson has observed, quote, contains an embryo nearly all his cardinal assumptions. Walt Whitman wrote and rewrote his great collection of poems, Leaves of Grass, over his entire adult lifetime, seeing it through 8 editions. Each of these authors was significantly better educated than Joseph Smith, and each was older than Smith when he completed his master work. Emerson was 38 when his first volume of essays was published. Thoreau was 37 when he published Walden. Hawthorne was 36 when The Scarlet Letter was published, and Melville 32 when Moby Dick was published. Whitman was 36 when he sent an autographed first edition of Leaves of Grass to Emerson. For each of Joseph Smith's contemporaries, not only is there evidence of early compositions that influenced the writer's masterpieces, but there is ample evidence that they all benefited from being part of a literary culture, one that was full of cross-fertilization. Emerson's influence on Thoreau and Whitman is well documented, as is Hawthorne's and on Melville's, and vice versa. Although Emerson's shadow on the age is the longest, Emerson himself reveals and acknowledges indebtedness to a number of European writers, including Swedenborg, Carlyle, Coleridge, and Goethe. Where are the tri-works of Joseph Smith? Where is the evidence of his writing out his subject matter, form, and style, working out his subject matter, form, and style? What evidence we have shows a young writer with little literary style or polish. Certainly there is evidence of the beginnings of an eloquent voice, but by the time the Book of Mormon was published, that voice was tentative and immature. Nowhere in Joseph Smith's early writing does one find the kind of literary imagination necessary to write a book which has been translated into more languages and sold more copies than any book written by Joseph Smith's illustrious contemporary authors. Like Joseph Smith, all of these writers were influenced by the King James Bible, and all of their works have allusions to and reflect in some ways biblical style, although none of their works reveals the depth and sophistication of biblical indebtedness as does the Book of Mormon. Unlike Joseph Smith, all of these writers show indebtedness to other writers, historical and contemporary. Where are the European or American writers who served as models or inspiration for Joseph Smith? There are no allusions in his writings or in the Book of Mormon to Cotton Mather, Edward Taylor, Jonathan Edwards, John Neal, James Fenimore Cooper, Charles Brockden Brown, Washington Irving, or even the more popular writers of the time who were, as David S. Reynolds says, quote, part of a heterogeneous culture which had strong elements of the criminal, the erotic, and the demonic. The popular hunger for sensational, sentimental literature seems not to have infiltrated Joseph Smith's creative imagination. Reynolds describes, quote, the seamy fiction written in a succinctly American and rational style whose linguistic wildness and dislocations were also visible in the grotesque American humor that arose during this period. In relation to the writers of the American Renaissance, Eugene England has observed, Joseph Smith thus strikes straight to the heart of the major epistemological and ontological dilemma the great romantics struggled with, and his resolution was no mere compromise, but can be understood as an integration of the great romantic impulses and classical realities. Although literary critics have essentially ignored Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon, and I think it is scandalous that this is so. Reynolds, in this in wonderfully impressive book, Beneath the American Renaissance, doesn't even mention the Book of Mormon, which might, had he taken it seriously, been a book that would have fit into his categories. Some critics have begun to see something significant in this author and in the book they attribute to him. Although literary critics have essentially ignored Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon, and it is scandalous that this is so, some critics have begun to see something significant in this author and the book they attribute to him. Harold Bloom, one of the preeminent scholars of his generation, praised Joseph Smith in relation to his contemporary writers. He says, I myself can think of no other American except for Emerson and Whitman who so moves and alters my own imagination. So self-educated was he that he transcends Emerson and Whitman in my imagination, in my imaginative response, and takes his place with the great figures of our fiction, since at moments he appears larger than life in the mode of a Shakespearean character. So rich and varied a personality, so vital a spark of divinity, is almost beyond the limits of the human as we normally construe those limits. And yet Bloom,
A master at deciphering and delineating texts seems to have missed much of the intricate complexity of the Book of Mormon. He saw it, along with other scriptures in the Latter-day Saint canon, as, quote, the stunted stepchildren of the Bible. He summarizes it this way. It has bravura, but beyond question, it is wholly tendentious and frequently tedious. Excuse me. If one compares, alliteration can be puzzling at times. If one compares it closely to Smith's imaginings in The Pearl of Great Price and The Doctrine and Covenant, it seems to be the work of some other writer. And he is quick to add, and I don't mean Mormon or Moroni. What about talent? Was Joseph Smith a creative writer? Did he have narrative or fictional capabilities similar to his contemporaries Cooper, Melville, or Hawthorne? Did he have any poetic abilities similar to Emerson, Lowell, or Whitman? Or was he a lesser light, like John Neal or William Gilmore Sims? Or could he be placed even in this company? Although Harold Bloom praises Joseph Smith's charisma and imagination, he sees him as, quote, an indifferent writer. While Joseph Smith achieves moments of eloquence, and while there's evidence that he was beginning to develop a mature style by the time he was martyred, in none of his writings is there evidence of either the narrative style or the poetic complexity one finds in the Book of Mormon. In fact, as Richard Russ points out, quote, I have spent a good deal of time reading the journals and letters of Joseph Smith, and I consider his style to differ markedly from the style, really the styles, I find in the Book of Mormon. I contend that not only was the composition of the Book of Mormon far beyond Joseph Smith's capabilities, but that he had no idea as to the subtleties and complexities of the text. There is no evidence that he knew anything about writing intricate parallel literary structures, that he was able to create the wide range of characters found in the Book of Mormon, that he had the inventiveness to create a complicated fictional plot, or that he had the ability to write in a variety of styles. Ed Ashmont is not convinced by the word print studies of Hilton, Larson, Rencher, and Layton, but whether their methods are sound or not, there is no disputing the fact that there are a number of strikingly different authorial voices in the Book of Mormon, a task that is extremely challenging, especially if one is creating an entire narrative orally. I've just finished reading Barbara Kingsolver's The Poisonwood Bible, and in there, those who've read it know she uses at least five different voices, and an impressive alteration of styles, and yet it seems to me that in a number of places she betrays her own narrative voice. Again, quoting from Harold Bloom, who, as I suggested earlier, did not imply his incisive critical mind seriously to the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith's life, personality, and visions far transcended his talents and the composition of divine texts. What about knowledge? What did Joseph Smith know, and when did he know it? Where could someone living in eastern New York in 1828 have gone to obtain the knowledge base for writing the Book of Mormon? What would an uneducated person living on the edge of the American frontier need to know? Here are a few of the many things selected almost at random. He would have had to know the English Bible more thoroughly, more deeply, and more intricately than any of us knows it, including a knowledge of its many kinds of parallelisms and poetic forms, its various cultures, its characters, images, and symbols, and its legal system. How well did Joseph Smith know the Bible? In her memoirs, Lucy Max Smith, his mother, recalled that as a boy of 18, not too long before the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith, quote, had never read the Bible through in his life. Moreover, she said, he seemed much less inclined to the perusal of books than any of the rest of our children, although given to meditation and deep study. I would guess that I know the Bible at least as well as Joseph Smith knew it at the age of 24. I have 3 degrees in literature, and I know a great deal about poetic and narrative form, and yet I was completely unaware of the existence of chiasmus until it was pointed out to me. I have been teaching and writing about literary texts for 35 years, and yet I did not see some of the narrative subtleties that Mark Thomas points out in Digging in Cumorah. Joseph Smith would have had to have a thorough knowledge of olive horticulture. How likely is it that someone raised on an American farm would have known the detailed information contained in Jacob's parable of the olive tree? Joseph Smith would have known wheat and beans, but my guess is that he wouldn't have known beans about olives. He would have had to know how to take his characters through the Arabian desert. As Jean England has summarized, quote, "For Joseph Smith to have so well succeeded in producing over 20 unique details in the description of an ancient travel route through one of the least known areas of the world, all of which have been subsequently verified, requires extraordinary, unreasonable faith in his natural genius or his ability to guess right in direct opposition to the prevailing knowledge of his time." He would have had to know that the use of Baal and El names were out of favor during Lehi's time, but not during the time of the Jaredites. I would guess that Joseph Smith had no idea as to when it was and wasn't appropriate to use such names. He would have had to know that the name Alma, which anyone living in the 19th century knew as a Latinate woman's name, was also, as Daniel Peterson has pointed out, an authentically ancient Semitic masculine personal name. Interestingly, as I pointed out 35 years ago, Melville, I think, picked up that name, Alma, because he uses it as the name of his main male character in his novel, Marty. And there is substantial evidence that Melville had read the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith would have had to know not only that chiasmus was an ancient poetic and mnemonic device, but to be able to compose numerous examples, some of them extremely complex, by dictating them spontaneously. As John W. Welch has stated, the Book of Mormon, especially in its most literary portions, is replete with precise and extensive chiastic compositions. After citing an example of chiasmus in Mosiah 5:10-12, Welch states, "Again, the repetition here is precise, extensive, and meaningful. It simply strains reason to imagine that such structure in this oration occurred accidentally." Emma Smith, who knew Joseph more intimately than anyone, said her husband had limited knowledge of spelling and, quote, "could neither write nor dictate a coherent and well-worded letter, let alone dictate a book like the Book of Mormon." In an interview with her son, Joseph Smith III, she reported, "I am satisfied that no man could have dictated the writing of the manuscripts unless he was inspired. For when acting as his scribe, your father would dictate to me hour after hour, and when returning after meals or after interruptions, he would at once begin where he had left off without either seeing the manuscript or having any portion of it read back to him. This was a usual thing for him to do. It would have been improbable that a learned man could thus translate the Book of Mormon, and for one as unlearned as he was, it was simply impossible." I might say that Emma, like a lot of those of us who have honest and candid wives, was not hesitant to speak candidly about her husband's failures and faults. Hyman Smith spoke of his brother's inability to produce such a book on his own. To say that a man of Joseph's ability, who at that time did not know how to pronounce the word Nephi, could write a book of 600 pages as correct as the Book of Mormon without supernatural power. This seems to be corroborated by two interviews David Whitmer gave toward the end of his life. In one he says, "In translating the character Smith, who was illiterate and but little versed in biblical lore, was oft-times compelled to spell the words out, not knowing the correct pronunciation. And sometimes Joseph could not pronounce the words correctly, having little education." Those who assisted him in the translation testified that he dictated the narrative of the people of Lehi for sometimes hours on end, day after day, without any reference materials, and that he would pick the dictation the following day at the very place where he left off, with no prompting to tell him where in the narrative he should continue. Early theories that Smith copied the book from another author, or that it was written by Oliver Cowdery or someone else, was based on the assumption by those who knew him that Joseph Smith simply did not have the education or intelligence to write such a book. What about imagination? While many critics disagree on a number of aspects of Joseph Smith's character, there is almost universal agreement that he had an unusually creative and energetic imagination. Fawn Brody said he had, quote, "a marvelously fecund imagination and an extraordinary capacity for fancy." Harold Bloom has praised him as having an extraordinary capacity for speculative development. But what we know of Joseph Smith at the time he produced the Book of Mormon reveals no proclivity for artistic expression. That is, there is an enormous difference between being able to conceive of something imaginatively and being able to shape it into something concrete. If this were not the case, I would be a very wealthy and well-known novelist. Many of us may think of wonderful novels we would like to write or symphonies we would like to compose, but only those with true gifts are able to produce novels or symphonies. What about sophistication? Joseph was, according to his contemporary accounts, a rather typical frontier figure. He had little education, culture, or polish. Jan Shipps calls him an unsophisticated farm boy. From all we can tell, he had little, if any, knowledge of history, of languages, of the arts and humanities, except for a few passages in the Doctrine and Covenants and some of his sermons, all of which were written after he had expanded his education. There is nothing in Joseph Smith's writing that reveals what we might call a sophisticated literary style. In fact, like many of his American contemporaries, Joseph Smith wrote in a plain style, and this is very different from the style we find in the Book of Mormon. I first learned of the literary depth of the Book of Mormon from my teacher, Robert Thomas. Thomas, who had written his undergraduate thesis at Reed College on the Book of Mormon as Hebrew literature, was the first scholar to see the intricate biblical parallelisms in the book. Richard Dilworth Rust, in his valuable study, The Literary Testimony of the Book of Mormon, gives a much more detailed and comprehensive analysis of the book's many literary forms and styles, opening the text in many new ways. In his brilliant new study of the Book of Mormon narratives, Digging in Cumorah, Reclaiming the Book of Mormon Narratives, Mark Thomas describes the book as, quote, complex, subtle, unique, and artful. He says it has, quote, enormous variety and great subtlety, that it uses the Bible in diverse and intricate ways. He adds, it would be difficult to find a more original religious text. Thomas speaks of its use of symbol systems, image patterns, shadows, figures, repetitive triads, and narrative linkings. What I value most about Thomas' study is that it cracks open the text of the Book of Mormon to reveal its heretofore hidden brilliant structures, its deep complexities, and its narrative inventiveness. Thomas has not only enlightened my understanding of the book by the evidence he presents, he bolsters my argument that the book is what it claims to be. Thomas's reading of the Book of Mormon illustrates what David S. Reynolds says of the text. The distinguishing quality of the literary text is not radical subversiveness, but unique suggestiveness and great reconstructive power. I've tried to think of an analogy that fits the idea of Joseph Smith writing the Book of Mormon. To me, it would be as if a frontier craftsman who was a maker of rag rugs were suddenly to produce an oriental rug that required a knowledge of the ancient tradition of weaving, dyes, and fabrics, and then wove a rug of such complexity that only in the 20th century was someone able to discern or decipher its intricate figures or patterns. Since I teach analogies, I'm aware of the weakness of them, but bear with me. Or it would be like a frontiersman who could pluck out a few bars of Yankee Doodle Dandy on a banjo, being able to verbally compose and dictate an elaborate fugue or symphony for full chorus and orchestra. I think Nibley still has the best analogy. To put it facetiously, but not unfairly, and it may be unfair, but still, the artist who set out to create such a work must not only balance a bowl of goldfish and three lighted candles on the end of a broomstick while fighting off a swarm of gadflies, but he must at the same time be carving an immortal piece of statuary from a lump of solid diorite. Two cultures and one strategy. The heart of the problem in relation to Book of Mormon scholarship, as I see it, is that those on both sides of the argument seem to be talking past one another, or to use Paul's words, to be speaking into the air. Often, I might add, air of their own making. Thus, Edward Ashman comments at the end of his essay, "A Record in the Language of My Father, Evidence of Ancient Egyptian and Hebrew in the Book of Mormon," quote, "Unfortunately, there is no direct evidence to support the historical claims of the Book of Mormon, nothing archaeological, nothing philological. As a result, those for whom truth is the product of spiritual witness, not empirical inquiry, resort to developing analogies and parallels to defend the book's historical claims. That is the apologetic historical methodology." It is interesting that this charge is similar to that leveled against the naturalist critics by the apologist, who see them as developing analogies and parallels to attack the book's historicity. Ashmont's dismissal of the apologist methodology is no less disturbing to me in its tone than that of the 14 apologists who reviewed new approaches to the Book of Mormon for Farms, one of whom found Ashmont, who is referred to as, quote, an insurance salesman who once studied Egyptology at the University of Chicago. This reminds me of the George Lyman Kittredge was the great Shakespearean teacher and scholar at Harvard, and when some of his students suggested that he might consider getting a PhD, he said, pray who would examine me. Anyway, the referring of Ashmont, the reference to Ashmont as having a, quote, faulty and occasionally amusing methodology is to me unfair, a cheap shot. Although I have lived most of my life in the academic world where this type of unchristian behavior is all too typical, and where, as Hugh Nibley has observed, the university has become a place essentially to show off, I don't think there should be a place for nastiness or insults in our discussions. We should all be humble in the face of our vast ignorances and respectful of those who are in opposition to us. As John Stuart Mill says, for while everyone well knows himself to be fallible, few think it necessary to take any precautions against their own fallibility, or to admit the supposition that any opinion of which they feel very certain may be one of the examples of the error of which they acknowledge themselves to be liable. Mill also states, it is only by the collision of diverse opinions that the truth has any chance of being supplied. Perhaps there is reason for each side to distrust or at least to be suspicious of the other. Each side has been, in my judgment, too quick to dismiss the methods and observations of the other, too quick to question the motives and scholarship of their opponents, too quick to rest a judgment about the other's discoveries. We need to recognize that as extremes, each position is limited. Those who defend the Book of Mormon primarily with their testimonies tend not to be open to some of the hard questions and real challenges the book presents in its claim to be a translation of an authentic text. They need to acknowledge that some questions raised by those who do not believe the Book of Mormon is divine are legitimate, and that not everyone who questions Joseph Smith's account is an enemy of the truth or of the church. They need to understand that merely invoking spiritual authority closes off dialogue. On the other side, those who refute the divine origin of the book tend not to respect the spiritual experience of believers or to be open to those evidences that suggest the book has an ancient primary source. They also need to acknowledge the challenges that face their scholarship if they contend that Joseph Smith was the author of the book. If the believers' apologists tend to be overly pious, the non-believers' naturalists tend to be a little too enamored of what they consider to be empirical proofs. A tentative theory. It occurs to me that what the critics and apologists are caught in here is a hopeless and seemingly endless dialectic. Each side has dug in for the long battle, and each side uses whatever weapons in its arsenal it feels it has to in order to defend its position. I know it is a radical idea, but what if neither side was completely right or completely wrong? In other words, what if there were a third option? I doubt that such an option would be tenable to some on either side because it would mean retreating from their lines drawn in the cement. But as I read the Book of Mormon and try objectively and fairly to consider the arguments on each side, and as I try to incorporate both my intellectual and spiritual experiences with the Book of Mormon, which have been consistent over a lifetime, I have come to the conclusion, and again let me state that it's tentative, that the Book of Mormon may be genuinely both an ancient and a modern book. By this I mean that I believe that there were real people named Nephi, Alma, Moroni, and Mormon, and that they lived and wrote on the American continent. The record they kept was like the records kept by other ancient peoples, and that it contained both a chronicle of their cultural experience and religious history, and was expressed in the forms and styles of their literary tradition, so that what thoughts and feelings they hoped to pass on to future generations was translated or expressed in the language and through the experience of Joseph Smith's 19th century mind. That is, in his revision of the Bible and with the books of Moses and Abraham, Joseph seemed to have created new and revised texts through revelation. For example, I think that David Wright argues persuasively that in his expression of ideas found in Alma 12 and 13, Joseph Smith, quote-unquote, transformed Paul's letter to the Hebrews rather than, as some traditional rationalists argue, that there was an ancient prototype that served as a source for both Alma and Hebrews. While Wright's argument is persuasive, I don't agree with him when he states, it goes almost without saying that this conclusion means that the rest of the Book of Mormon was composed by Joseph Smith. The position that I present here is similar to that presented by Blake Osler in his essay, The Book of Mormon as an Expansion of an Ancient Source. Osler presents a persuasive argument for the possibility of both an ancient source and a modern transformation of that source, so that the book presents, quote, a modern worldview and theological understanding superimposed on the Book of Mormon text from the plates. My argument is more conservative than Osler's, although it is somewhat parallel. That is, it seems to me that one has to do too many intellectual and spiritual gymnastics either to see the Book of Mormon as a complete and literal translation of an ancient text source or to see it merely as a product of a 19th century mind. On the other hand, there are simply too many things in the book that neither Joseph Smith nor anyone else in his day could possibly have known. Too many complexities, subtleties, and intricacies in the text that were beyond his or any of his contemporaries' capabilities. Too many examples of spiritual depth and profound expression that were certainly beyond his cognitive or expressive abilities when the Book of Mormon was published. I believe that the integrity of the text requires us to look for the source of all of these things outside the mind of Joseph Smith. On the other hand, there are matters of composition, style, subject matter in the book that require us to have a more liberal, open concept of translation, to include transformation, expansion, extrapolation, and perhaps even invention. That is, it would not be surprising that as Joseph Smith was translating, he came to prophecies concerning our day, in which he took the basic idea presented by an ancient author and through inspiration expanded on it, or, as in the case of Alma 12:13, turned to a scripture with which he was familiar in order to find a fuller expression of the idea. I distrust two kinds of Mormons, those who never think and those who only think. The former are part of a strong anti-intellectual strain in Mormonism that unfortunately is still very much alive today. They tend to forget, as Sir Thomas More says in Robert Bolt's A Man for All Seasons, that God created us that we might serve him fitfully in the tangle of our minds. Or as an Episcopalian ad has it, Christ came to take away our sins, not our minds. We are not simply to testify of the hope that is in us, but as Paul said, to give reasons for it. But if believers need to be reminded, so to speak, that God expects us to think, non-believers or skeptics need to remember, which means to pass through the heart again, literally, that God gave us hearts as well as minds and that he expects us to use them, too, in seeking for the truth. Increasingly, scientists are speaking of what they call heart intelligence or emotional intelligence, ways of knowing that are different from but which complement cognitive intelligence. It is thus by thinking and feeling, by intuition and inspiration as well as by cognition that we may have the best chance of arriving at the truth, keeping in mind that neither heart nor mind nor the two in concert are infallible. Frost speaks of poetry as a thought-felt thing, which may also be a good way for us to think of the best critical evaluation. Eugene England argues that this is the only way to understand Joseph Smith himself. If we are better to know him, better to know his history, which he said we would never know until the judgment day, we must know both his heart and his mind much better than we have. The danger of our age is that we have become too intoxicated with reason, too slavishly dependent on strict empirical processes. In his important book, Voltaire's Bastards, The Dictatorship of Reason in the West, John Ralston Saul chronicled to which we have exaggerated the importance of reason since the Enlightenment. The price we have paid for this over-reliance on the mind is that we have become increasingly scientific, technological, and mechanistic. As Saul says, with the Enlightenment, quote, reason began abruptly to separate itself from and to outdistance the more and more or less recognized human characteristics, spirit, appetite, faith, and emotion but also intuition, will, and most important, experience. And Saul says, if you doubt that that this age of reason has really been an age of reason, look at what the rationalists have done to and with women for the past 300 years, basically ignored them. Or if you think that we live in a rational society, consider the fact that in Utah it is permissible to carry a loaded gun to church, which is defended as rational. Saul speaks of what he calls the theology of pure power in discussing the extent to which technology, the military-industrial complex, the rise of the management class, and globalization have come to dominate our culture. As Saul says, the very problems which theoretically set off the original desire for reason have now reappeared as the official tools of reason. Nowhere is this tyranny more evident than in our universities and in our scholarly processes. Sometimes the least likely place to look for truth, whatever that is in books or in libraries. As Ezra Pound says of Jesus, they'll no get him in a book, I think, though they write it cunningly. Thus, God or the devil may be found in the details, but I think not in the footnotes. In his new book, Life is a Miracle, An Essay Against Modern Superstition, Wendell Berry speaks of the current scientific reductionism that sees the world and everything in it as if they were mechanical and predictable. Like Saul, Berry deplores what he sees as, quote, the preeminence of mind. Berry speaks of the academic hubris that thinks it can understand the world when it has no ability to confront mystery or even the unknown as such, and therefore has learned none of the lessons that humans have always learned when they have confronted the mystery. When we accept the non-rational or mysterious as empirically or rationally solvable, then of course we never find them. This is what Wallace Stevens means when he says, to lose sensibility, to see only what one sees, sight had not its own miraculous thrift, to hear only what one hears, one meaning alone, as if the paradise of meaning ceased to be paradise, it is this to be destitute. This is the sky divested of its fountains. Or to quote one of Stevens' proverbs, poetry must resist the intelligence almost successfully. By this, I think Stevens means that even with poetry, and he would probably add religion, we must keep some hold of the mind. Stevens might also have said that intelligence must resist the poetic almost successfully. Over the years, I've had a number of conversations with students, colleagues, and fellow writers about the Book of Mormon. When Kurt Vonnegut asked me how I could possibly believe the book, I replied that if I were intellectually and honest with myself, I could not discount either my experience as a textual critic or as a reader who surrenders himself to the book's spirit. I gave a similar response to my friend Allen Ginsberg when we were sitting in a restaurant in Suzhou, China. When I told him about Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon, he looked at me and said incredulously, "This is believed?" I assured him that it was indeed believed by me and by many others. Mark Thomas says, "This visionary book speaks to us, children of the enlightenment, of the non-rational spiritual world." I believe this is so, but I also believe that it speaks to us of the rational world, of the analytical and discursive processes of the mind. We need both in concert with one another in approaching so challenging a text. This reminds me of the lovely poem by Lisa Miller about Einstein, who we tend to think of as the super rationalist. And the poem is called On Finding a Bird's Bones in the Woods. And imagine Einstein walking through the forest and looking down and seeing the bones of a small bird. And Lisa Miller says, on finding a bird's bones in the woods, even Einstein, unlearning the bag and baggage of notion, must have kept some shred with which to clothe the shape. He, examining the tranquil core under the boil and burning of faith and metaphor, must have kept some shred with which to clothe the shape, as we, who cannot escape imagination, swaddle this tiny world of bone in all that we have known of sound and motion. So that when we come upon a bird's bones in the woods, the ability to make it come alive and sing and fly again requires imagination, and Einstein had that kind of imagination. Well, my conclusion. I've tried to demonstrate that Joseph Smith did not possess the talent, imagination, knowledge, or sophistication necessary to write the Book of Mormon. nor was the time in which the book was produced sufficient to compose such a lengthy and elaborate narrative as he possessed all of these things. Could any of Joseph Smith's more illustrious contemporary authors have written the book? I don't believe, and these are writers that I've taught for my whole professional life, I don't believe that Emerson, Hawthorne, Melville, Thoreau, and Whitman, colossal writers that they were, together, could have written the Book of Mormon. Further, I don't believe that if all the scholars in the world in 1829 had gathered in a large room and had access to every extant book and manuscript and had a decade to work on it, that they could have written such a book. That is my seriously considered scholarly opinion. There is simply too much that the book points to that no one in the 19th century knew. A coda. What has led me to that belief is both an intellectual and a spiritual conviction. As a scholar, I believe that the best and most inclusive objective evidence, the most persuasive empirical evidence, taking into account all that is persuasive, even if it is contradictory, leads to the conclusion that no one living in the world in 1829, let alone an untutored and glorious farmer, could have produced the Book of Mormon. And yet it bears the unmistakable imprint of Joseph Smith's own 19th century mind and heart. The Book of Mormon speaks to my heart as well as to my mind, and I have come to trust that experience as real and valid. I am challenged by it to be a better Christian. I find my understanding of God broadened by my understanding of Jesus Christ deepened by the words of this book. As I said in an essay I once wrote, it has opened my heart wider to experience his love. I rejoice in a book that has such an expression as Moroni's final invitation. Come unto Christ and be perfected in him, and if ye by the grace of God are perfect in Christ, then are ye sanctified in Christ by the grace of God through the shedding of the blood of Christ, which is in the covenant of the Father, and to the remission of your sins, that ye become holy and without spot. Thank you.
It is an honor for me to be here and respond to this paper with its generosity, with its thoughtfulness, and to be with you, many of whom I look to as quiet heroes. I recently read the account of one of the three Helmut Hubner group, the Germans, young youth who opposed Hitler. And I was amazed as Schneba, one of the young men, was in prison for this opposition and later in a camp of Russians when they captured him and still wanted him as a German prisoner. He was on the wrong side of both groups. I was amazed at the heroism that the people in those groups showed upon the pain of death, for example, when British soldiers were starved to death in Poland and Russia, that these young Germans who were the opponents of this group snuck bread to them, snuck water to them to save their lives. That's just one of hundreds of examples that even in the worst and most brutal times, that small acts of heroism have gone unnoticed and have saved people. And I look in this audience and I see those kinds of heroes, and I thank you. I will not forget you. Today in my remarks, I wish to take just a few minutes. An undramatic drama. To drain all drama out of this discussion, in a three-act play, entitled, according to what Dr. Reese has already quoted, Serving God Fitfully in the Tangle of Our Minds. Act 1, The Fascination of Forgery. Act 2, Could the Book of Mormon Been a Forgery? And Act 3, Welcome Dr. Robert A. Reese to the lovely world of Mormon warfare. Act 1. There's something quite intriguing about a forgery. People do it for a variety of reasons. Forged money, forged checks, credit cards, license plates. It can be for fame, it can be for money, it can be for ego, it can be for trickery, it can be for the sheer joy of going uncaught. I recall one of the great violinists of the 20th century who didn't think he had a chance at becoming a great violinist. There were too many good violinists around. How he as a young violinist could break through. So he decided to write what he claimed were Mozart violin pieces. He played them, became famous, and it was only later discovered what he'd done, and by then he was a famous enough violinist that that didn't matter anymore. I'm reminded also of biblical scholarship that has carefully and thoughtfully weeded out the forgeries, the obvious ones, the childhood narratives of Jesus, where Jesus makes clay and they magically fly, and the birds that he's fashioned with this clay. I'm reminded, as biblical scholars have gone closer and closer to the text and pronounced generally that the many of the epistles of Paul were really not written by him, though some were. And even delving into the New Testament text itself, the Gospels, trying to weed out what was authentically the words of Jesus, what was not. Unfortunately, we as Mormons have not been very careful about noting the lessons of this careful scholarship. As witnessed by the Mark Hoffman case, I recall years ago in Sunstone, when it caught everyone off guard, when this was announced, the best scholars available didn't realize this clever forger had done his job so well. And I suspect that the best forgers will never be known by us because they haven't been caught. A bit disturbing. But that leads us to Act 2. Could the Book of Mormon have been a forgery? And to Dr. Reese's statements, I would like to add the warfare that is currently going on in Mormonism. We ought to be lucky, unlike those German soldiers in camps. We ought to be lucky that we can almost be as free with speech as we would like. Almost. But not quite. I'm reminded of the groups at farms, the apologist at BYU, and the instances where he cited that they have essentially relied on ad hominem attacks, at personal attacks, to try to defend their position. Misrepresentation, disappointing, I must say. To this group, I would like to simply cite the 13th Article of Faith. We believe in being honest, true, chaste, benevolent, virtuous, and in doing good to all men. You don't save your religion by destroying it. The second group I would like to address and simply point out is that's already been pointed out in this paper are the people who confound their own scholarship with anybody else's scholarship. Let me give you the general paradigm of opponents of Mormonism. Critical scholarship is scholarship that points out that the Book of Mormon is a 19th century product. Apologists are scholars that point out that it's ancient. Critical scholars are good. Apologists are bad. Hence, my argument is correct. That's the basic argument of much of what I see passing as scholarship. And to respond, I simply was not clear in my book, I don't think, on this point after reading this paper. I was appealing to those who are apologists to simply set down their biases and look at the Book of Mormon carefully. And I consider those who will not look at the Book of Mormon as possibly ancient as being an apologist. Both sides of the argument are apologists. As far as I'm concerned, they're appealing to evidence simply to support what they want to support. And that leads us to Act 3. As Cromwell supposedly said, think that you may be wrong. This has been quite a delightful experience because reading Dr. Reese's paper, because what he is essentially saying is we ought to put together what I would call the scholarship of confidence. where we could get a group of scholars together and we could sit down and say, here's my evidence and here's your evidence. Let's listen carefully. If you have something that may change my mind, I'd love to hear it. But what we have, again, is a warfare. And there may be good reason why we have pistols in churches. I think warfare might break out in such a conference. But what would not only happen, I am quite convinced today, that there is somewhere among us someone representing the church that is monitoring what we say. That's a disappointment.
Actually, I was the one appointed.
Is that right? I think that is perhaps why such scholarship of confidence is impossible today. I believe that as Mormons, it is our duty to search for the truth carefully and thoughtfully, and the only way we can do that is by hearing all sides of the argument. We need to get scholars together. We need to examine carefully. What does a testimony mean? Get some philosophy people talking about that. That would be an interesting topic. This inner word of God, this mysticism, what does that really amount to? And to have Catholics talk about it, and have Protestants talk about it, and have atheists talk about it. And we ought to all recognize that in some sense, Joseph Smith was a prophet, because a prophet is a person that stands on the mundane, between the mundane and the spiritual world, and with psychic means somehow communicates what he or she perceives. You don't have to be a Mormon to accept that. I'm not offended by saying that. What's the problem? The real question is, what's the spiritual world? You know, what is the content there? Is it a mere dream? Is it a mirror? I don't know if I want to use the mirror. Is it a dream? Are there real beings? That's the question. The arguments being posed seem to me to be over the wrong issues altogether. And it was delightful to see Robert discuss these so diligently, but that takes the drama out of this play, because what we're saying is people ought to listen carefully to the truth, and in the end they'll be happy to accept the truth, and that Mormonism in the end is based on the truth, whatever that truth might be. That's good enough for me. So I have for the past 20 years resolutely avoided the issue of the authorship of the Book of Mormon, and find myself wondering, am I the right person to respond to this? I don't have the nerve for the warfare. I'm personally not interested in it. My research is a strange kind. It's based on love and generosity, which doesn't work very well in this kind of battle. And so I'm pleasantly surprised to see this scholarship of confidence, this serving God fitfully in the tangle of our minds being espoused here. I hope it works. As for me, I think I will go out and buy a prune d'Agen, a plum that monks discovered in Iran when they were on the Crusades. I'd like to plant one of those. I'd like to get a plant of the Amish, the tomatoes, the luscious tomatoes that they grew that you can't find anymore. I would like to get my viola out and go to a rest home and play for the weary. And in 10 years, Dr. Reese, call me back up, and I'll be happy to play at the funeral of those who have died in this battle. And along with that funeral, I would like to hear that beautiful, simple melody, Fare Eis Requiem, Dona Eis Requiem, Dona Eis Requiem, Sempre Eternum Requiem, Dona Eis Requiem. Men cry, as Jeremiah said, peace, peace, but there is no peace. The engines of war are already around us. And as Isaiah had his visit in the temple, as God was casually visiting, he tells of the people of Israel, however hard they listen, they will never understand. However hard they look, they will never perceive. This people's wits are dulled. They have stopped their ears and shut their eyes, so that they may not see with their eyes, nor listen with their ears, nor understand with their wits, and then turn and be healed. And I pray for that healing from the battle that I see. I do not wish to participate in it. I have not the nerve for it. I wish you, Dr. Reese, my best and farewell where'er you may fare.
We don't have as much time as we'd like, but we'll...
We do have time for a few questions, and let me just say that I strongly commend to your reading Mark Thomas's excellent book. He really has opened the Book of Mormon in ways that no one else has, so I hope you will get it and read it. We do have time for perhaps a couple of questions. Anyone? Yes, Robert. And the statement is that really it's a confirmation of what Mark Thomas's book is about, is stop arguing and start reading, which isn't really bad advice for all of us. I think that the part of what, as I was looking at the Book of Mormon in relation to the American Renaissance, I was thinking about the fact that I've taught those authors all of my life, and I've also taught Joseph Smith's book all of my life, and I, you know, when my wife and I served as missionaries for 3.5 years in the Baltic states, to see people who had never seen that book and see it open to them in ways that that changed their lives. The other night, some of the returned mission presidents from South Africa were talking about that when Africans read this book, they say, "I'm a Nephite. This is my book. This speaks to my heart." And you think about in all of these languages throughout the world that this book does. Again, you think if this were the composition of Joseph Smith, he's accomplished what no other writer in history has done, was to create a sacred text out of his own imagination that has such a that has really been the center of the first new world religion since Muhammad wrote his book, which took him, by the way, 25 years. Okay, any questions? Yes, over here. Yes, brother. Well, I don't know. You're all prospering, it seems to me. Okay, let me... yes, I apologize for giving you a superficial answer. Every sacred text, it seems to me, including and maybe even especially the Bible, contains things that are part of the consciousness and the experience of the people who wrote it. I think that part of what we... our challenge as writers in any generation is to use the best of our hearts and minds to look at that text, and if we find, as we do, racism or sexism or dishonesty or whatever it is in those texts, that we speak about that. There are many people who find many things in the Bible disturbing, and as you look at the saga of the central families in the Old Testament, you will not find anything different than what you find in the saga of the great central family in the Book of Mormon, or the families in the Book of Mormon. In his book of Conversations about Genesis, Bill Moyer's commentators talk about the dysfunction of the families of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the limitations of those people. As we look within, part of what I'm saying, you know, one of the mission presidents the other night very touchingly said, "I was called to Africa, and I wasn't ready to go because I had racist feelings toward blacks." Here was a man, you know, brought up in the church, a leader, a good and noble man, and he said, "I had to fast and pray for a long time and ask God to remove that from my heart." And that's what I think each of us does in relation to any text, sacred or otherwise. If we find something in the New Testament or in the Old Testament or in the Apocrypha or in any sacred book that is out of harmony with our own best spiritual insights, it's necessary for us to come to terms with that. So yes, there are problems in the Book of Mormon. Whether the righteous prosper always and it was part of Job's complaint that the people who seem to be the worst people were prospering. As we look around us, that seems to be the case. I simply think these are the problems of any sacred text.
That precipitated much of it.
Well, it's very clear that as much as we don't know very much about the process of translation. I think we have to take what we have, which suggests that Joseph Smith basically was dictating it to his scribes. If Joseph and Oliver discussed certain passages, and if Oliver had an influence on Joseph in terms of the discussion of these ideas and produced a better text, that's okay with me, as long as what we have. I mean, part of what one point which I probably do disagree with Mark is that he wants to get back to the original meaning, saying that, for example, some of the texts have been changed so that you've got pure and delightsome instead of white and delightsome. If you're really interested in the text and what it communicates, and it seems to me it, there's improvement on the text, you'd be glad about it, as I'm glad about that particular one. Again, I think the best answer to your question is that there's so much we don't know. But what we do know is rather substantial. And it was that Joseph Smith somehow, and I don't understand how, if Joseph Smith had a small computer in that hat, and he had somebody who was sending all of that stuff to him, and he was reading it and getting it out, you might say, well, okay, this was some kind of a subterfuge, but I'm sorry. As a scholar, I simply find that so vastly incredible that it's hard for me to accept it as a rationalist. Well, the question is, why would there need to be any changes? Anyone who has written a book or written articles, and you've certainly written some, and you're becoming famous now as a writer, realize that you finish it. The people have written things under what they felt were inspiration. Handel felt he was in a rush of inspiration when he wrote Messiah, but he went back and changed some things. I think, again, we need to trust the process, which is that if we believe in divine inspiration, that it isn't absolutely infallible. I mean, God could have come down and simply written it out and said, here it is. It comes through the voice, the mind, the experience of another person. And, again, if Joseph Smith is not knowing how to spell things and somebody writes it and he gets back and looks at it later and says, yeah, I wonder if that's what I meant. Or if somebody says, didn't you think you meant this? For example, in the waters of Judah, the waters of baptism, he might have thought, that's a much better expression. I think that's probably what it did mean. That is, if we get away from the sense of this being technically exacting process and look at it like all human processes. I can tell you there are times when I felt that I've spoken under the power of inspiration. When people said to me, when you spoke, I saw an aura around you. It scared me a little bit, but they did say that. But when I looked at what I said, I thought, yeah, I wish I'd said it a little bit differently.
Wish we knew.
I think that's really true. As I look out here and see the most distinguished critic in Mormonism, Wayne Booth, I think of the impact he's had on scholarship. And it reminded me of a little incident that I think illustrates what I was talking about, the fallibility of scholarship. When I first started teaching American literature after I got my graduate degree and was at UCLA, everyone was reading Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage. And scholar after scholar talked about the fact that an episode in that book which says the sun was pasted in the sky like a red wafer. You read commentary after commentary about this being sacramental element and James Compton being Jesus Christ and Henry Fleming being Heavenly Father and all kinds of this other kind of Christian interpretation. And some freshman at a university in the South, and going across some documents, found that when the Civil War soldiers put the wadding into the cannon, they referred to it as a wafer. So the Crane wasn't thinking about sacramental emblems at all, and yet a generation of scholars had picked this up and used it and was certain that this is what it meant. Every text is open, and every interpretation of every text is tentative, religious or otherwise. And we should be humble in the face of every text. I can tell you, I've taught a book like Billy Budd probably 30 times. Every time I teach it, I've got to reevaluate how I see it and how I think about it and what I thought Melville was intending. It is a text that perplexes me, and I cannot be doctrinaire about it. And I think we just need to be very respectful of those texts and our own ability to come to terms with them. Thank you again very much.